Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, this week we had the spring equinox, and it was pretty nice till the weekend that brought some weather to remind us not to put away our winter gear to ward off the chill just yet. The moon is waxing, and where the snow is still piled up, the glow at night is pretty strong. Monday, March 25th, the full moon is called the worm moon because March is seen as the time of year when the ground begins to warm up and thaw, and thus when earthworms begin to move back to the upper layers of the soil. And there is a penumbral eclipse of the moon expected to begin in Bozeman at 10:53 p.m. Sunday, March 24th. It will reach maximum around 1:12 a.m. Monday morning, March 25th. So at that time, as I understand it, you'll just be able to see a little bit of the moon shining. So let's hope for clear skies Sunday night into Monday. Today's episode of Desert Oracle Radio was produced by Ken Lane on March 26th, 2020, and it's titled Trailed by 20 Hounds. He was looking forward to an easing of COVID restrictions right around Beltane and May Day, which are the same day, and his thoughts wind around to the Grateful Dead before he's done. Enjoy.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. Hey, and did you hear the good news? The good news about how we're gonna open up the country again by Beltane, you know, May Day, May 1st. That would be a beautiful thing. The thing about spring equinox, vernal is kind of a dumb sounding name. I mean, sure, it's from Latin, vernus, that's nice, var in Old Norse, spring, we get it. But when you say vernal, especially up here in the high desert where I am, I mean just out here in Hicksville, you say vernal and it sounds like somebody's cousin, you know? Hey, your cousin has kind of been hanging around, upsetting my dogs. Oh, you mean Vernal? Well, he don't mean nothing. He's just out there smoking dope. It ain't illegal. Right. I don't care about the dope. I just sort of wish maybe he'd go stand on the opposite end of the road. Lean on his own truck. Give me a little space. The dogs are already on edge. It's like, when is he going to leave again? It's been, what, 2 weeks? Is he ever going to leave us alone again? So the thing about spring equinox is that's just the turn of the season. You're at the start, and depending on where you are, it's still kind of cold. You still have your coat in the truck, especially with that wind. There's nothing colder to a desert person than being blasted by that icy wind coming off the mountains with those last couple of storms. Because you are ready for the spring at this point, and it keeps being sort of cold. I mean, of all the things to complain about, I know. It's not a complaint anyway, it's an observation. So once you get to Beltane or May Day, May 1st, the weather is generally about as beautiful as it gets in this part of the world. Really, in all of America, most of Europe, all around the Northern Hemisphere. And it's coming up, and we're all cooped up like a bunch of wind-up chickens trying to do the right thing. Now, I don't have any science or data or whatever you want to call it. But to my mind, I think it would be a beautiful thing to open up the country for Beltane. May Day. And you know, we can keep our social distance if we still have to. But we can all hope to take part in the all-night fertility rituals on Beltane Eve, around the great bonfires set up in every town square and park, golf course. All you can see is a lot of shadows of, I guess, naked people up there in the bushes and the junipers. Just like bunnies, I mean everywhere. Maybe those are actually bunnies. It is spring, after all. And you've got the old-fashioned pinwheel fireworks like in the Hobbit movies. And sure, we have been through a lot, but now it's Beltane. And we raise our individual compostable goblets of holy wine. Everybody's there. Most of us made it through. I was walking with the dog the other day, and I heard a cactus wren just yakking and cackling as they do. It was up there in a Joshua tree, just on the lookout. They make their nest in a cholla, you know? And the cholla needs to be about 3 feet tall before it's high enough for a cactus wren to leave its eggs there. Otherwise, the coyotes will just eat the eggs right out of the nest. It's like a breakfast buffet. But you know what they say in the desert, the cactus wren is a cactus friend. Now, May Day, what the followers of St. Minerva call Beltane in the Northern Hemisphere, is celebrated around the world, but rarely in the land of America. It's a holiday that celebrates nature and humanity together at last. And it's especially about community. And the funny thing is that May Day is an American holiday, an American invention. People have been celebrating Beltane as a sacred festival for many thousands of years. But the labor holiday, the workers' holiday, began right here in America in the years following the Civil War. In the years when people were worked to death 16 hours a day in gruesome slaughterhouses and smoke-filled factories. Let me read you something about this historical moment from the International Workers of the World. A year before the Haymarket Massacre, Samuel Fielden pointed out in the anarchist newspaper, The Alarm, that whether a man works 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day, he is still a slave. Despite the misgivings of many of the anarchists, an estimated 250,000 workers in the Chicago area became directly involved in the crusade to implement the 8-hour workday, including the Trades and Labor Assembly, the Socialistic Labor Party, and the local Knights of Labor. The posters and the workers' newspapers proclaimed, Make your demand for 8 hours with weapons in your hands to meet the capitalistic bloodhounds, police, and militia in proper manner. Not surprisingly, the entire city was prepared for mass bloodshed reminiscent of the railroad strike a decade earlier, when police and soldiers gunned down hundreds of striking workers. On May 1, 1886, more than 300,000 workers and 13,000 businesses across the U.S. walked off their jobs in the first May Day celebration in history. In Chicago, the epicenter for the 8-hour day agitators, 40,000 went out on strike with the anarchists in the forefront of the public's eye. With their fiery speeches and direct action, anarchists became respected and embraced by the working people and despised by the capitalists. May Day, 1886.
St. Stephen with the rose, singing out of the garden he goes, country garden in the wind and the rain.
You know, the Grateful Dead does come up a lot. That's what we had scheduled to talk about.
That's right. And we're gonna talk about the Grateful Dead. And even if this doesn't float your boat, it's an interesting story, and we're not going to, like, play a bunch of the music or anything. So hang in there, and if you have a desert musical artist that you'd like to hear featured on Desert Oracle Radio, we actually do research and that kind of stuff. Let us know. It's radio@desertoracle.com. And there has never been a band, I think, anywhere, at any point in history, anywhere in the world, that has created the long-term community that a band out of San Francisco that used to be called the Warlocks has created through their long career. And that's the Grateful Dead. And let's have Jason P. Woodbury tell us a real interesting desert story about this American institution.
Well, so obviously the Grateful Dead are tremendously associated with San Francisco, and that's where the Dead was birthed, and that's really where most of the group's story, which is wild and sprawls over the course of decades, takes place. But the idea of the American Southwest, the sort of mythic desert, is kind of threaded all throughout the band's history. I mean, obviously, you can think about the cowboy songs of Bob Weir, you know, and everybody's tolerance for Bobby's cowboy songs is different, so maybe that's your least favorite part of the Grateful Dead. You know, or maybe it's your most favorite, but it's all throughout there, you know, these sort of cowboy ballads. And then the desert was kind of overshadowing things when they were making their sophomore album, Anthem of the Sun. Bob Weir, once again, had requested recordings of desert air. He called it thick air, you know? So these guys were sort of obsessed with the idea of the desert, so much to the point that when they eventually made their way to the pyramids at Giza in 1978, they played to this crowd of desert Bedouins off in the distance, people who hadn't bought tickets but just sort of came from the surrounding area. So I always find it fascinating that the Dead seem to have this affinity for the desert. And as somebody who has got more into the group in the last decade or so, inspired predominantly by Arthur Magazine suggesting that the band's catalog was worth more than my punk rock friends and peers had led me to believe, I started, you know, getting into the Dead, and I've always wondered about the desert's role in the band's music, because there's not a ton of stuff beyond, of course, tours through the American Southwest that connects the band to the desert. But it felt to me like there was something deeper there, and after a while, I realized that there kind of was. Three of the most famous Dead songs from the band's early era, St. Stephen, China Cat Sunflower, and Alligator, were actually written by lyricist Robert Hunter, who didn't sing with the band, but was a longtime friend of Jerry Garcia and at one point musical partner. But he wrote those three Dead classics while living in Arizona and New Mexico.
Really? So this would have been in the late 1960s, presumably before Bob Hunter moved with Garcia to a house in Marin, I believe, in 69.
So it would have been before that. They had gone back for a while. You know, he was born in 1941. You know, he went to high school in Connecticut. But he returned in the early 60s back to California. And he hooked up with a young Jerry Garcia and would hang out. And they had like a little folk combo. And they would study old blues records and all that stuff. And it was around that time that he got involved in course in government-sponsored LSD tests at Stanford University, which is a strange little hiccup in the story there. But the CIA was very interested in LSD at the time.
Right. Now, Kesey also was part of this Stanford government research program, wasn't he?
That's right. That's right.
And did Hunter and Kesey come together through that program? I know that the Dead eventually became the house band at La Honda.
That's right. So they kind of separated, but they had all been around. And at some point in the 60s, you know, Hunter reconnects with Jerry Garcia. They kind of went separate. They went their separate ways. They were involved. Hunter and all these folks at Stanford University in these LSD trials, and that of course impacted their various activities. The Dead went on to become the house party at the acid tests, and was involved as this whole new movement was blooming. Garcia was sort of spearheading that, and then Hunter went off to the desert, and he sort of started hanging around, and he was in like Lake Havasu and bumming around New Mexico when they got in touch again, Garcia and Hunter, and Garcia suggested that Hunter start writing up some lyrics for this band. That's one of the really interesting things about the Grateful Dead, is that while there are lyrics written by the group, they employed two other pretty much full-time lyricists, you know? Bob right. Hunter had John Perry Barlow, you know?
And both of those guys are now gone.
Yeah, and in recent years, yeah. And then Hunter had hooked up with Garcia. So Garcia would send him, you know, ideas, and Hunter would send back these lyrics that Garcia could then use and draw from. Sometimes there was some editing in the studio by other members of the band. I'm thinking of Pigpen, who Hunter was pretty furious when people tinkered with his words like that, but it still happened. I went back and I listened to those songs, those three specifically that I could had evidence that were written in the desert, and I went and listened to them. Alligator and China Cat Sunflower, not picking up on a lot of desert vibes from those songs. St. Stephen does have some, you know, talks about the barren lack of rain beneath the sky and refers to the manzanitas dark and shiny in the breeze, you know.
That's some real desert nature writing there, involving things like manzanita, which is not the first desert plant that someone would bring up if they weren't familiar with the flora and fauna.
Yeah, you get the sense that he was somebody who was, I mean, the nature writing within the body of the Grateful Dead's music is pretty intense, you know, from everybody who worked with the group. There's beautiful descriptions, drawn in part, of course, from those old folk ballad, you know, sort of roots that the group had. But yeah, just really beautiful lyric writing about natural spaces, the desert and otherwise. I mean, you listen to a song like Dark Star, and it's, you know, it's this kind of cosmic nature writing that in, you know, a lot of ways was pretty profound sort of like poetry about these galactic and astronomical. That stuff wasn't floating around in every circle quite so freely as it is now, you know?
Hey, you want to hear a weird story about St. Stephen?
I would love to hear a weird story about St. Stephen.
So, some decades back, this would have been in the early 1990s, I had returned from living and working and making music in Eastern Europe, primarily Prague. And I got back and I needed some work and I needed a home. And through a girl I was dating, I got hooked up with a San Francisco 49er. Not a gold miner, a football player. But he had done, I guess, one season, and then they, you know, benched him or whatever they say in football. But he had some money, and he needed to invest that money so he'd have income for the rest of his life because his athletic career ended in the first few months. But he got some money from his signing and all that. So he bought a decrepit old apartment building between Knob Hill and the Tenderloin, what we call the Tender Knob. And it was mostly Section 8 studios. People are going to have a hard time believing this, but believe it because you're probably going to see it in the next year or two. San Francisco was cheap and mostly abandoned. So it was very inexpensive to live there. You could get around without a car, taking Muni. I would take the cable car to work when I worked in the financial district on a temp job. So this guy was a deadhead, the first of the wealthy kind of yuppie deadheads I'd ever met. This was in the early 90s, kind of when that third wave of Grateful Dead popularity, which slowed but did not end with Jerry's death a couple of years after that, was happening. Yeah,
that was when the band was probably drawing the most people. I think maybe now it's been said that they're drawing even more, but that band was massive at the time.
They were huge. There had been a number of things that brought them back into the popular music consciousness. There was the tribute album. There were two tracks on there that I remember I'm still very fond of. One was Jane's Addiction doing Ripple.
Okay.
Beautiful. Really good. And the other, which I still like and I hear now and then on Dwight Yoakam's Sirius XM channel, Dwight with his classic 80s band with Pete Anderson on guitar doing Truckin'. And it is a great version of Truckin'. If you haven't heard it, call it up on your music server thing since the record stores are closed right now, but it's real good. So
yeah,
this
dedicated.
Thank you. Dedicated. I think there was also a good Los Lobos track on there.
Looks like a fantastic. You got Los Lobos and Lyle Lovett and Cowboy Junkies and Bruce Hornsby, who was in the band,
right?
You know, Bella, all these guys.
So
they were coming off that hit too.
Yeah, they had the hit with Touch of Grey, and that album did very well. They had a music video, all this stuff. Hunter wrote Touch of Grey, I believe. The lyrics.
He did, yeah.
And they're kind of bitter lyrics. They're not quite the Bob Hunter of 15 years ago who had more of a kind of Western romantic approach to things. At this time, he's like, every word the kids speak is obscene, and they haven't fed the dog in years, and etc. So this apartment building was named in honor of the song you're talking about, St. Stephen. So for a year plus or so, I managed this apartment building in the Tender Knob with a bunch of Section 8 people who had been treated very poorly by the previous slumlord. And, you know, I was expected to treat them poorly, too, and I could not do that. So I was the sweetheart of the rodeo over there. I just refused to evict anyone, and as a result, people would always give me drugs. It was just a sweet time to be alive. So that's the kind of aside we can do here when people are literally writing and saying, please put up some longer things that we can just leave on. So we're going to put up a longer version of this conversation beyond what you hear in the weekly 28-minute show. And tell me, what's the plot, so to speak, of St. Stephen?
St. Stephen's just sort of, it's this classic outlaw sort of song, you know? It's this song where St. Stephen, who's cruising around, he doesn't have a great reputation. The lyric talks about how wherever he goes, people all complain. But, you know, it's sort of this lyric ballad of this guy who has gathered up what others are kind of throwing away. Been here so long, he's got the got to go calling it home. It's just this insane sort of hippie ballad, I guess, about really sort of freedom and sort of living just outside of the law in a way.
Which they were real good at. Now, how long do you think Bob Hunter lived out in the desert before returning to full-time songwriting duties?
Well, it was just a couple of years that he was out there, you know, a couple of years in the late 60s. And then he got more connected to the group. And then, of course, went off and did his own thing. Bob Hunter did make a bunch of records, you know, he did his own records. He has a great song called Arizona Lightning, also on his record Tales of the Great Rum Runners from 1974, which has got members of the Dead on it. But he said he wrote that one in Lake Havasu while watching the Watergate hearing. So as you can imagine, not the exact same sense of, hey, what's going on? It feels like the end of the world that we're feeling right now, but probably something similar, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the dread was heavy in that time.
For me, when the Dead's music starts to get really resonant, it's when that hippie dream breaking down around them. You know what I mean? From the end of the 60s with Manson and Altamont, which the Dead played Altamont.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So
it was Jerry's idea to hire the Angels.
The band's sort of, I think, alliances with certain outlaw factions of the counterculture, including the Angels, who were not peace and love types, I think puts them in this weird position. You know, the Grateful Dead has always sort of had this idea of it's just sort of a facilitator of whatever needs to happen. It just creates the conditions for things to occur. And there's a little bit of that in the end of the 60s where people aren't necessarily always willing to take responsibility for asking the Grateful Dead to, or not the Grateful Dead, the Hell's Angels to run security, you know?
Well, they were not just interested in peace and love types, if that was ever a primary interest.
Sure.
They were interested in American archetypes. That's yeah. really what, to me, the lyrical story of the Dead is about. I want to tell you about one of my favorite Robert Hunter lyrics. I don't think we brought it up. Very much about the desert. It's a kind of Gold Rush, William Burroughs, Carlos Castaneda, kind of Wild West, you know, that specific weird, trippy, spaghetti western, outlaws, hippies in Virginia City dressed up like Victorian bartenders and opera singers. There's a lot of yeah. weird stuff going on. This one is close to my heart since my years living in Reno out in the Virginia foothills many years ago. And you know the one I'm talking about, yeah? I lit out from Reno. I was trailed by 20 hounds.
Yeah, yeah. Friend of the devil.
That's right. And he's headed east across the desert, across the Intermountain West. Spent that night in Utah in a cave up in the hills.
There you go. Like, the desert is always been where America projects all of its fantasies and its nightmares and its dreams, you know?
And it's where we often go try it, whether it be a utopian commune in Llano in the western Mojave or the great state of Utah, the Beehive State, and the many social experiments that they're still doing there. You gotta respect the approach to community and the approach to prepping. Not prepping in a nutty way, prepping in a way to get you through hard times, because they've gone through hard times when they came yep. out there. When we were first talking about this, the idea of Bob Hunter writing in the desert, and there's so much stuff just in Friend of the Devil. You got sheriffs, you got patrimony, you got polygamy, you know, all these southwestern things. From Amboy to Zizix and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio. We broadcast from Joshua Tree on Friday nights. You can get our podcast anywhere. And we've got a Patreon set up, and boy, do we appreciate the patrons about now. Thanks to Jason P. Woodbury from Zia Records and Aquarium Drunkard. Happy birthday to the cosmic cowboy in Tennessee, Jonathan Childers. And thanks, Leah, for that letter. Soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Well, March is Women's History Month, and I want to talk about a couple of remarkable women today from Montana. And before we do that, I have a couple of events I want to tell you about. Random Acts of Silliness is putting on a Cabinets of Curiosity show at the Story Mansion, and it's going to run March 23rd through April 14th. They say, immerse yourself in the curious collections of the mysterious Raven's Eye Society, a fictional club of collectors and explorers who traveled our world and beyond to gather the specimens contained in their magical cabinets of curiosity. Their beautiful and interactive cabinets, created by real Montana artists, are on display throughout the Story Mansion. Mesmerizing mementos, fanciful renditions of scientific specimens and artifacts, and even encapsulated sounds and memories. Ooh, that sounds right up my alley. So you can visit on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m., Fridays from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Sundays from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And it does say no reservations required to visit during these hours. It is closed on Mondays. And if you have a group of 15, they're strongly encouraged to sign up in advance. And just go to the randomactsofsilliness.com website for any more information or to find out what else they're doing. You know, I'm really, really grateful that the Earth Day festivities began early here in the Gallatin Valley. And if you go to the Gallatin Valley Earth Day website, it's gallatinvalleyearthday.org. They have the events listed that are going on. And coming up Thursday, March 28th at 6:30 p.m., it looks like they're showing a film called Trout, Drought, and Floods, How Trees Impact the Gallatin Watershed. Now, it could be it's actually a lecture, I'm not sure, but it has Lily McLean from the Gallatin Watershed Council listed. It is also sponsored by Montana Angler and Madison Gallatin Trout Unlimited. And again, that's at the library at 6:30 p.m. March 28th, which is Thursday. And if you go to the GallatinValleyEarthDay.org website, you can register for live stream to receive the link. And it's all free. So enjoy that. I think when you're new to a place, you pay more attention to details, whether it's history or natural features. I grew up in Nebraska, and I didn't come to Montana until 2004. And so there are so many things here and people here that are just fascinating to me. Well, one of them that I recently came across was Montana's own Jeanette Rankin. In 1916, she became the first woman in U.S. history elected to the House of Representatives. This was remarkable because most American women were not able to vote until the 19th Amendment passed in 1920. One of the things she said was, quote, "We're half the people. We should be half the Congress." I totally agree with that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think right now women are still only about 29% of the House of Representatives. She also said, You can no more win a war than you can win an earthquake. And she also said, if I had my life to live over, I would do it all again, but this time I would be nastier. I like that one. Well, if you want to hear more about her story, there is a podcast called Fierce that did an episode titled Jeanette Rankin, the First U.S. Congresswoman. It's a pretty good one. You might enjoy it. Well, if you're a regular listener to this program, by now you probably have figured out I am a capital W wilderness advocate. A woman I only recently found out about was quite the mover and shaker for wilderness in Montana. Her name is Florence Baldwin, and here's a little about her. Though Florence doesn't always get the credit, I gotta believe that she was just as much as hard a worker on this cause as her husband Ken. The article in the Independent Record begins with, every acre of wilderness in Montana is thanks, at least in part, to Ken and Florence Baldwin. As hunters and outdoor enthusiasts, the Baldwins began noticing a troubling decline in wildlife in the 1930s. By 1958, Ken had served as president of the Montana Wildlife Federation and Gallatin Sportsmen's Association, and wrote that it was necessary that wildlands be set aside to leave the habitat for those animals. In 1958, Kent sent letters to 100 friends and colleagues seeking support for a congressional wilderness bill. Within 2 weeks, 21 Montanans met at Bozeman's Baxter Hotel and formed the Montana Wilderness Association, naming Ken the president. In 1962, the Baldwins led a group of 40 hikers into the Table Mountain and Spanish Peaks, intending to build grassroots support. The hike led to creation of MWA's Wilderness Walks, which remain popular to this day. The Baldwins continued to organize support for the Wilderness Act, which garnered sponsorship from Montana senators until it passed in 1964. The landmark law established the Bob Marshall Cabinet, Gates of the Mountains, Anaconda Pintler, and Selway Bitterroot Wilderness Areas, and serves as the foundation for all other wildernesses to follow. And that information came from the Montana Outdoor Hall of Fame biographies. Earlier this week, I sat down with longtime conservation advocate Joan Montaigne, who had some personal memories of Florence.
My name is Joan Montaigne, and I've been a longtime conservationist here in Bozeman. We started the Madison-Gallatin Alliance to bring forth the Lee Metcalf Wilderness in 3 years, and we succeeded. I knew Florence Baldwin that way, and then I've been on the Great Yellowstone Coalition board, I'm very fond of Florence.
So how did you first meet her?
I met Florence through the Montana Wilderness Association annual meetings. She was the secretary treasurer from when she and her husband started the Montana Wilderness Association in 1958, and they had very simple life. He ran the local Sinclair, I think, gas dealership. But they just loved wildlands, and they at first time you wouldn't think them being somebody who would go into the wild parts of Montana, but they spent a lot of time camping and organizing lots of people to fight for the wild parts of Montana.
Do you know, what particularly prompted her and her husband to do this? Like, was there something they were seeing, or a progression of events, anything like that?
Well, they both like to hunt, and they were members of the Montana Wildlife Federation. But I think they just were one of the few people in the state back in the 50s who even thought that maybe we would not always have the land that we, public lands, preserved in their wild state. Florence was certainly tenacious, and she was unrelenting in her lobbying of place for protection of places she loved. She and Ken were definitely of the old school, and it was a little hard for her to see all the new people coming in to the organizations. In Great Falls at an annual meeting was appointed treasurer. I had just become a member. And Florence wouldn't give up the books. She really, really did not want to relinquish power. And I had to get the books out of, so it wasn't given straight away. I had to get the books out of a barn in Belgrade where she had given a friend all of the receipts from the annual meeting 3 months before. And in the hay mow of the barn, where the horses were eating even, was $5,000 in cash from the annual meeting that Florence had put in envelopes. And anyway, that was sort of sad because they, you know, she had done a good job until then, but she just couldn't quite give up. She and Ken came all the way back from California in their little teeny trailer to be inducted into the Montana Hall of Fame in the middle of a snowstorm in the winter, and they were pretty elderly at that point. We celebrated when the 50th anniversary of when Ken and Florence got a bunch of local people together in Bozeman at the Baxter Hotel, including my father-in-law and John Montaigne. And we celebrated with a pancake dinner over at where they had their very first wilderness walk in the Carrizy Mountains. And we served like 500 pancakes on the grill. And that was sort of the beginning of when people got together, not realizing other people love these wild places the same as they did. And I think the Baldwins really helped to get people together to celebrate.
Okay.
Ken and Florence were some of the last of the old guard who were real advocates for certain things, like they tried to protect the Lindley Park Center, which was the United Travelers had always re-roofed it and taken care of it, and the city of Bozeman said, okay, we want it back. And Florence fought that for quite a while, saying we're the ones that should have the say about this. Florence was just one of those women in the 50s who spoke out. And thinking back of my own mother, you know, women didn't do that back in the 1950s.
Yeah.
You know, I try to think of how she and Ken got people to get behind them. But back in those days, it was pretty hard to communicate without social media and things. And I'm really impressed to think about how in those early days a couple like that could get something going and rally people around them. They were definitely the old school, and they didn't have much money, and they were real true blue. I mean, they were the honest, you know, honest people.
And did they initiate getting wilderness designation for any areas in Montana?
The 1964 Wilderness Act was, you know, they were part of that lobbying, and I'm thinking that that's probably when Florence was doing a lot of letter writing, but it wasn't until after the 64 Wilderness Act sort of that things really started happening, and I think they were pretty elderly by then.
Okay, so yeah, that makes sense. So she and her husband Ken laid the groundwork.
Right.
So that was in place once the wilderness designation was a possibility. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you wish I asked, or anything else you'd like to tell me?
She was a stalwart of Montana Wilderness Association, which is the oldest wilderness advocacy group in the United States. I mean, it was the first one, 1958.
I did not know that.
Okay. When they convened the meeting in 1958 to form the Montana Wilderness Association, which is now called Wild Montana, mm-hmm. They had probably six or seven of the outfitters in the Gallatin Canyon who had dude ranches, and they got all the wildlife hunters, the guided hunters, and there were some people from western Montana, but it was mostly around Bozeman, and that's what makes it sort of sad that their whole emphasis was on protecting the Madison and Gallatin ranges, and that the Gallatin range is still not protected.
My thanks to Ken Lane for sharing his work on Desert Oracle Radio, and to Joan Montaigne for sharing her memories of Florence Baldwin. I'm hoping to interview her down the road. Our sounds today included the birds and a squirrel in my yard and water dripping from my roof while I recorded them. Also, we heard the Missouri River headwaters. You can call or text me at 406-404-6246 with anything you'd like to say, hear, or talk about. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I have a little final thought today. I wonder what Jeanette Rankin and Florence Baldwin would be standing up for in today's world and how they would do it. They and Joan Montaigne were and are women with passion for their causes. Passion can break your heart, but passion also carries you forward. So hold on to your passion. Sia is taking us out today with Unstoppable. Till next week, stay well and sweet dreams.
I'll smile, I know what it takes to fool this town. I'll do it till the sun goes down and all through the night time. Oh yeah, oh yeah, I'll tell you what you wanna hear. Keep my sunglasses on while I shed a tear. It's never the right time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm moving.
I'm so confident.
Every single